Today's podcast of The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
Talk about a dramatic turnaround. Last year, Ford Motor Company lost a record $14 billion. But the Detroit automaker won both the Car and Truck of the Year awards, and tomorrow, it could post its first profit since 2005. I talked to Ford CEO Alan Mulally and asked him how he was feeling.
Fine, thanks.
Pretty good, better than last year about this time, right?
what a difference a year makes. To admit it's getting better,
it's a little better all the time. The State of the Union for Ford is strong, not just in Detroit, but also on The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee from Public Radio International and WNYC.
Good morning. It's Wednesday, January 27th, and The Takeaway from my interview with Mulally, John, was he the luckiest guy ever or the most prescient?
Have you looked at a Ford quarterly statement lately?
No, but I want to for once, for the first time in a long time.
Let's get right to the top stories we're following this morning. President Obama will use his first State of the Union address tonight to try to convince Americans he's got a plan to stem the tide of red ink and create some jobs. White House spokesman Robert Gibbs.
The president will talk about ensuring that we begin to get our fiscal house in order.
Here's what we know so far. The president will reportedly call for a boost in education spending, a change in the way student loans are guaranteed. He'll also outline a new response to bioterrorism attacks, as well as go over his plans to help middle-class families. And with the federal deficit out of control, President Obama is expected to issue an executive order creating a task force to tackle the deficit, an idea that was voted down in the Senate yesterday. Indiana Senator Evan Bayh says reducing the $1.3 trillion deficit is a critical step.
I have not detected a level of anger and cynicism about the federal government in my lifetime as high as it is today.
It may affect the ratings. The president's address is tonight at 9 p.m. Eastern Time.
Analysts are calling Toyota's move unprecedented. It's suspending U.S. sales of 8 of its most popular models, including the Camry and the Corolla, while it works to fix faulty gas pedals. Toyota is also planning to stop production at 6 North American plants starting next week. Toyota shares fell nearly 5% on the Tokyo Stock Exchange this morning. Back to Ford. I spoke to Ford CEO Alan Mulally yesterday, and I asked if he thought Ford is going to post a profit tomorrow.
Well, you absolutely have the right date. That's the date we're going to do our fourth quarter and year-end results, and at that time we'll update the fourth quarter performance, our year-end performance, and also provide our guidance for 2010.
That's a creative way to not answer the question. Ford earnings come out tomorrow, and industry experts are predicting they will post a profit. And we're going to continue that conversation with Ford CEO Alan Mulally in a moment.
So Ford expecting a profit. GM finally found a buyer for Saab. It signed a deal yesterday with a small Dutch automaker, Spyker Cars. Out of London this morning, a two-day international conference on Yemen and Afghanistan begins today. U.S. Special Envoy Richard Holbrooke says the U.S. will support Afghan President Hamid Karzai's plan to reintegrate the Taliban fighters. The idea is to convince low and mid-level Taliban soldiers who don't back al-Qaeda to give up their fight against NATO forces.
Here at home, voters in Oregon have voted to raise taxes on businesses and the people who earn more than six figures a year. And at the Australian Open today, defending champ Serena Williams advanced to the semifinals. She will not be joined by her sister Venus, who lost this morning. Futures are up in the markets, although Asian and European markets are down. The Dow will start at 10,194. The S&P opens at 1,092 and the NASDAQ at 2203. So later in the hour, she's not Julia Child, but she is a child.
Today we're making a sage risotto with pecorino cheese. It's going to be gooey.
We're going to talk to an 11-year-old chef for tips on how to cook with your kids and make it fun and delicious later in the hour.
She eats pecorino cheese. Oh, my goodness.
She does.
Tonight is President Obama's State of the Union address. We want to give you a chance to weigh in. What are your six words to describe the state of our union or the state of Obama's job performance?
This is William Victor. I'm a school bus driver. My name is Obama, not Chris Angel.
Oh, my goodness. We love it. Keep them coming. 877-8-MY-TAKE with your take or post it at our website, thetakeaway.org. Coming up, Alan Mulally of Ford.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee.
Ford Motor Company lost billions in 2008, but when they announce their earnings tomorrow, it may turn out that 2009 was considerably different. What does that say about the state of our union and economy? Maybe it only says something about our next guest, Alan Mulally, the president and CEO of the Ford Motor Company. I spoke to him yesterday from the Washington Auto Show. Ford earned just shy of $2 billion in the first 9 months of 2009, and I asked Mulally how he's turned it around for Ford.
Well, I think I would take us back to 3 years ago, where we developed a point of view about the kind of company that we wanted to create with Ford. And at that time, we decided that we were going to focus on the Ford brand. So that led us to divest of the other brands, as everybody knows. And then we also decided that we were going to have a complete family of vehicles that the consumers wanted in every market segment. So small, medium, and large cars, utilities, and trucks. We also decided, Celeste, at that time, that every new vehicle that we designed and produced would be best in class. And we defined that in terms of quality, fuel efficiency, safety, smart design that makes us even a better driver, and, of course, the very best value. And so we went to the banks. We got the financing in place for this tremendous transformation. And, you know, clearly during the worst of times as the recession increased, we had sufficient liquidity so we could continue on our plan. We accelerated the development of the new products and services that you're seeing today. And we restructured ourselves to get back to profitability, as you pointed out, in the third quarter. So we are here now as the recession as it starts to turn that with the products that people really do want and value. And it's very gratifying to see the response that we're getting for the new products.
Let me ask you about the state of the union for the auto industry. I mean, the auto industry that used to be just the cornerstone of the American economy, not just the American economy, but the American middle class. What is the state of the union for the auto industry now? Will it ever be the cornerstone that it once was?
Well, I sure think so, Celeste, because the United States has a very, very viable automobile industry. I mean, it's a very robust automobile market. The neat thing about Ford is that we are actually now growing our market share in the United States and around the world, which is terrific for our customers as well as you know, everybody associated with the automobile industry. Another thing, Celeste, I think is neat about the U.S. auto industry and Ford in particular is that we are part of the solution for energy independence, energy security, national defense, sustainability. So this is an important industry for all of us in the United States and around the world.
Well, now the auto industry is becoming a leader. They kind of had to be drugged kicking and screaming into that. But it feels like perhaps when you talk about a viable auto industry, that really what you're talking about is the new face of the auto industry, which is much leaner, much fewer dealerships, not nearly as high starting wages as we were used to. You know, this is not the same exact auto industry which established Detroit as the richest city in the world at one point and created this very well-off middle class. This is a leaner and, in some cases, cheaper auto industry.
That's there's a lot of truth in that, but of course, the most important thing as an industry, because this is business, is to make sure that you do have your businesses sized so the production is matching the current demand. And that was a very important part of our plan, is that we brought our production down to match the current demand, which was lower as we went through this recession. I think you're seeing just a fundamentally different strategy, as you pointed out, by the Detroit companies, especially Ford.
Alan Mulally is president and CEO of the Ford Motor Company. I spoke with him yesterday from the Washington Auto Show, and I continued the conversation by asking him about the state of the union for CEOs. He's the president of a company that really was founded by the man who's the stereotypical, the iconic CEO, Henry Ford. And I asked him how that's changed.
Well, Celeste, I'd go even further with your thought, because I think it's a very, very important thought. The most compelling thing about Henry Ford was that he had a very clear, compelling vision for the Ford Motor Company. I remember this quote that the real compelling vision for Ford was to open the highways to all mankind. So at the most fundamental level, I think that job, that contribution, that unique contribution of a CEO to formulate and articulate a compelling vision for the business is still probably the most important thing. It doesn't mean that you do it by yourself, but you work with all the stakeholders, you come together on what the business is really about, who the customers are going to be, what unique thing we're going to do to serve our customers. And in Ford's case, the most exciting thing about Ford is we are now accelerating the implementation of Henry's original vision. Because you look at now us focusing on Ford, a full product line, best in class in quality and fuel efficiency and safety, serving all of the customers around the world, but leveraging our size and our capability. I mean, this was Henry Ford's original vision, and we are now accelerating that vision. And I think that's a very unique, important contribution of the CEO.
But for a company like Ford, like the Big Three, or any large company, Xerox even, Delta Airlines, to a certain extent, you're a figurehead that has to take responsibility when things don't go right. I remember watching the footage of you going to Washington and having to answer the criticism of these congressmen who, you know, having covered the auto industry for a long time, had not been cooperative with the auto industry before, but were then harshly critical of decisions that were made 10, 20, even 30 years before you took the helm at Ford. So to a certain extent, a CEO has to take the fall sometimes.
Well, I think at a CEO level, you have a tremendous responsibility to all the stakeholders associated with the enterprise, the customers, our dealers, our suppliers, all the Ford employees, the UAW, our government leaders throughout the states and in the federal level. So you're absolutely right. There is a lot of responsibility, but also it's very rewarding and very satisfying and very fun.
This is a look at the State of the Union address that the president will be delivering, and we're asking different people, looking back, what do you think is the State of the Union right now? What would you say the state of our country is?
Well, I think that it's been pretty well articulated by many people that, clearly living within our means, getting the economy growing again, facilitating businesses investing and leading economic development, our trade imbalance, our deficits, our choices, what we do with our precious taxpayer money. I think these are all very, very important issues that everybody is working on. I'm looking forward to hearing what the president sees for us and what the state is and what he sees for us going forward.
Alan Mulally is the president and CEO of the Ford Motor Company. What's your State of the Union? Can you tell us in six words or less? 877-8-MY-TAKE or go to mytake@thetakeaway.org. So now at 15 minutes past the hour, let's check in on the headlines.
President gives his first State of the Union address tonight, and as you're watching it, you can give us a ring at 877-8-MY-TAKE with your reactions to the applause lines, to everything, anything in detail that you want to go into. That's 877-8-MY-TAKE. But tonight's speech comes as the president's poll numbers have been slipping. Earlier, we spoke with Pittsburgh radio host Bev Smith. She says some of her listeners don't understand why the country's long-term problems are being blamed on the current administration.
And that's what has my audience puzzled. Totally puzzled why people are so willing not to give this president a chance when they gave Bush 8 years and he destroyed this country.
A sentiment not likely to be explicitly in Barack Obama's speech tonight, but blame aside, aides say the president will accept responsibility for not delivering on some campaign promises.
The president's also expected to address the $1.3 trillion deficit tonight. Yesterday, the Senate rejected a proposal to create a task force to address the debt, but that doesn't mean Congress is not concerned. Senator John McCain says drastic measures are needed.
That requires hatchets and scalpels. It requires a hatchet to bring it under control, and it requires the scalpel to eliminate the wasteful and unnecessary spending.
Sticking with national debt, the nonpartisan Congressional Budget Office says last year's $787 billion stimulus bill actually cost $75 billion more than that. That's due in part to spending on jobless benefits. And James Cameron has topped, well, himself. His film Avatar passed Titanic to become the biggest box office hit of all time. That's a look at some of the stories we're watching this morning. Coming up, the State of Our Union. We're going to get a message from the president tonight, but we get your message in a moment.
Hey, you want that to go?
Well, that devastating earthquake hit Haiti 2 weeks ago yesterday, and the president of Haiti is now appealing to the international community for hundreds of thousands of tents and millions of ready-to-eat meal rations. His call came as donor nations and charities met in Canada to plan aid efforts. What's the current situation in Haiti? Karen Allen has that answer for us. She's the BBC correspondent there. Good morning, Karen.
Good morning.
Can you tell me what the reaction of the Haitian people is to the calls by their president for more help?
Well, I think they would concur totally. There is a real sense of desperation, and people here know that they're going to be reliant very much on the international community, at least in the initial stages, to be able to begin the process of turning Haiti around. As you can imagine, there are still large numbers of international aid agencies operating here in the hospitals, on the streets, trying to remove some of the rubble, trying to still pick their way through to respond to the occasional calls that there may still be survivors, although officially the rescue aspect of the search has actually been called off some days ago. So there is an understanding, and there is a real sense here among Haitians that, you know, they are in a desperate situation. I was yesterday at the epicenter of the earthquake, a place called Léogane, where virtually every building you come across in what was the main high street is reduced to rubble. People are living in vast tented areas, makeshift camps. The hope is to be able to move them to more formal, organised tented cities. And there are people there who are accountants, they're students, they're people who had good jobs, now reduced to living in complete poverty.
How do they feel? You know, we heard from a member of the Italian government saying that the United States is not doing enough. Is there that same sense among the Haitians?
There is a sense of impatience, and certainly the president and the first lady yesterday implored Haitians to be peaceful, but also to appreciate that vast amounts of the infrastructure has been destroyed here, and that includes government buildings, includes the judiciary, includes the tax office, it includes all the different mechanisms of state that usually make things work. I mean, the president himself is going to be living in a tent because his presidential palace was destroyed. So there are calls for people to be patient. The aid agencies are slowly getting help out. People are getting access to food. I've seen several food distributions. People are getting tarpaulins and tents. It may not be happening as quick as they would like. But as I say, the call is that, look, this is a very different situation to, say, the tsunami in the Asian tsunami, which happened over a much wider spread area. This is a very, very concentrated catastrophe. And as a result, the people have already very, very poor. The poorest country in the Western Hemisphere have been hit extremely hard, and there isn't the internal means to be able to deal with it, and that's why we've got so many agencies coming in to try and lend assistance. And the big challenge is trying to join up the dots and make sure those different agencies are coordinating properly.
Okay, great. Thank you so much. Karen Allen is a correspondent in Haiti for our partner, the BBC.
We go now to Southern California. Steve Gorman is a reporter for Reuters in Los Angeles, where throughout California, particularly in Los Angeles, there is a thriving retail trade in marijuana because of the proliferation and legalization of medical marijuana. But advocates hit a major bump in the road after a city council vote in L.A. Steve, what happened?
Well, after more than 2 years of debate and deliberation, the city council yesterday approved an ordinance to regulate medical marijuana dispensaries in Los Angeles, and the measure would shut down hundreds of these pot clinics that have sprouted up in the nation's second largest city since the Obama administration halted federal raids on them last year. So that's essentially what they've done, and they've established this ordinance would also impose restrictions not only on the, would cap the number of dispensaries that are allowed to operate at about 70 ultimately, which is just a fraction of the 1,000 or so that are out there today, but it also would place tough restrictions on where they can be located, the hours of operation, and so forth.
So is this going to be enforced through zoning, or are they particularly just going to go through and weed out, this one can stay, this one can go?
Well, there's ultimately, as I said, there'll be 70 of these stores that will be allowed to operate, but that number, about twice that number, would initially be allowed to stay in business under a grandfather clause, and that's for the clinics that were open prior to this a temporary moratorium that was established back in 2007. But essentially, they'll be controlled by, in terms of their numbers, by how far they can be away from, they have to be from schools, churches, libraries, and the like. And also, they've established buffer zones that keep them away from being either next door to, or across the street from, or across the alley from, or even on the same corner as any residential properties. So even among those dispensaries that are allowed to stay, some of them may have to actually relocate, perhaps to industrial areas and so on.
Finally, Steve, give me a sense. Do people in Los Angeles believe this whole medical marijuana experiment has been a failure because of the proliferation of retail outlets?
Well, I think it depends on sort of where you live. And, I mean, a lot of residents in areas where these things were sprouting up like crazy felt that it's gotten, you know, way out of hand. And they felt that, this was bringing the wrong element into their communities and that it needed to be, sort of controlled. The city council took a long time to get around to acting on this. And I think there's a feeling that that's one reason why it got to the point where it did and why the whole issue became as contentious as it did. Mayor Villaraigosa says he plans to sign the measure. Before it can take effect, the city has to enact a separate law establishing some new application fees for the dispensaries that are going to be operating. All that's expected to take at least 45 days, but the issue is far from settled because advocates of the dispensaries are already threatening to challenge it in court.
All right. Steve Gorman, reporter for Reuters in Los Angeles, about a Los Angeles City Council vote broadly restricting the number of retail sales outlets for medical marijuana. Thanks, Steve.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee.
Coming up, if you can't beat them, get them to join you. Is that NATO's new approach to the Taliban in Afghanistan? We'll talk about it in a new conference in London that begins deliberations this week. Right now, let's check in on the top news stories at 30 minutes after the hour. News this morning from that two-day international conference in London on Yemen and Afghanistan. U.S. Special Envoy Richard Holbrooke says the U.S. will support Afghan President Hamid Karzai's plan to reintegrate Taliban fighters. The idea is to convince low and mid-level Taliban soldiers who don't back al-Qaeda to give up their fight against NATO forces. Fotini Christia, a professor of political science at MIT, is coming up. We're going to talk more about that in just a moment. Current report in the Washington Post this morning is shedding light on the U.S. military's current role in Yemen. It says for the past 6 weeks, U.S. military teams and intelligence agencies have been involved in joint operations with Yemeni forces, and they say they've killed six of the top 15 leaders of al-Qaeda in Yemen. Americans reportedly don't take part in the raids, but they plan the missions and provide the weapons. We plan to speak with David Petraeus, the general at CENTCOM, later today, and we'll ask him about those reports in the Washington Post. The Post also says President Obama sent U.S. military forces briefly into Somalia last year as part of an operation to kill a terrorist thought to be behind the bombing of an Israeli resort in Kenya.
President Obama's first State of the Union address is tonight, and here's what we know so far about tonight's speech. The president will propose programs for education and middle-class families, also a spending freeze on some domestic programs, and an end to the ban on gays in the military. Earlier on The Takeaway, we spoke to Chicago talk show host Ray Hanania, who told us his listeners want the president to go beyond the rhetoric and take a tougher stand.
The big word I hear here, one of the biggest, is they want him to be tougher and they want him to deliver, and they don't feel he's done that.
Wow.
We want to give you a chance to weigh in on the issue, too. Give us your six words that describe the state of our union. Maybe this is a message for the president himself.
This is Carol from Metro Detroit. Jobs. Where the hell are they?
You can reach us at 8778-MY-TAKE or post it at our website, thetakeaway.org. And near the ancient ruins of Machu Picchu in Peru, about 475 tourists have been airlifted to safety after a mudslide blocked the only railway out of town. Checking in on the markets, Asian and European markets are down, but futures are up right now. The Dow gets underway at 10,194. The S&P opens at 1,092 and the NASDAQ at 2203. Those are some of the news stories that we're following this morning.
So we've mentioned a conference is opening in London this week, and leaders from 60 countries are going to focus on stabilizing Afghanistan. Today they're talking about Yemen, but Afghanistan is next up. And the central issue in that conference is likely to be something that Afghan President Hamid Karzai talked about. Listen.
Those Taliban who are not part of al-Qaeda and other terrorist networks, who are the sons of the Afghan soil, and who are in thousands and thousands and thousands, they have to be reintegrated, and they're welcome to be reintegrated.
That's Hamid Karzai speaking yesterday, talking about reintegrating and separating the bad Taliban from the good Taliban. Joining us now to see how practical that even is as a strategy and as a theme for Afghanistan going forward is Fotini Christia. She's a professor of political science at MIT and rejoins the program. Good morning, Fotini.
Hi, thanks for having me.
First of all, how difficult is it to separate productive Taliban who have a stake in the future of Afghanistan along lines that might be in the U.S. interest versus Taliban who would not want any part of a future Afghanistan in the way that President Obama might envision it?
Everybody understands that there's no way to get to peace within a reasonable time frame in Afghanistan without engaging with the Taliban in some sort of a negotiation framework. That's why they've come up with a plan of reintegration and reconciliation. The plan has been designed by the Afghan government, but it's going to be financed by the coalition of mostly Western NATO countries. The way they're proceeding forward is they basically expect the good Taliban to self-select into this program by structuring the incentives in a way that makes sense for them to join. They understand that the people they're going to be bringing in are going to be commanders and foot soldiers, and at this stage not people like Mullah Omar, who we consider irreconcilables.
Mullah Omar, right. That was the original partner of Osama bin Laden back in 2001, right?
He was basically the head of the Afghan state under the Taliban government.
How is this not a negotiation basically for a surrender to a series of power-sharing arrangements with the Taliban and others?
This is not a surrender because the Taliban is not going to be heading the state in any shape or form, however they join and whenever they join, if it's going to be earlier or later. This is going to be a power-sharing arrangement, and there are going to be a lot of ways to guarantee that this is self-sustaining and it makes sure that the Taliban can take over the whole country.
Now, to project that this deal or any deal might work, what we've seen since the surge was announced by President Obama is the NATO troops trying to hold territory outside of Kabul and Afghan authorities trying to maintain order in Kabul. How do you think that's going? And if a deal does get put together, will NATO forces have to stay in the countryside in places like Kandahar?
The plan is moving forward is actually quite impressive. They have plans indeed to move in with forces to clear territory that's controlled by Taliban forces, but then they're also bringing in elements of the government on the subnational level. So there's a plan for a district level initiative where the military moves in and clears, and then people are brought in practically at the same time, government officials, to ensure that there's some sort of governance in the area. And then they don't move in alone. They move in with the Afghan National Security Forces, that being the army and the police, because they have to be in charge of taking over security.
And you've witnessed some of this. I mean, I have to say, as someone who I've read repeatedly as a very harsh critic of the U.S. initiative in Afghanistan, for you to say this is impressive seems like a pretty significant turnaround.
What is impressive about this is the degree of knowledge of the local situation and the degree of mobilization and their willingness to involve the locals to the degree that they can. They understand that this has to be an Afghan-led initiative, and the support has to be from us, from our side, in order for it to succeed. But as I said, I was quite impressed with the degree of knowledge and mobilization on the local level.
All right. Fotini Christia, professor of political science at MIT. Let me turn your political science wisdom to the U.S. for a moment. I mean, if things go along the way you're describing, there will be some sort of end date for NATO in Afghanistan, and probably Osama bin Laden will still be there somewhere, and that for a lot of the American people, the conclusion of our initiative in Afghanistan will be, well, it's a place that maybe is a little friendlier and still some really bad people can live.
I mean, the whole idea with Afghanistan is, so long as it's not a staging ground for terrorist attacks against America, this is something that we should be happy to live with. It's never going to be, I mean, within a reasonable amount of time, it's not going to be a Western liberal type democracy, and this is something we have to live with. And that's not the objective of our presence there. We have to have some sort of power-sharing arrangement that makes the parties that live there happy with it. But so long as it's not a threat to our national security, I mean, this is what we need to be aspiring to.
All right, so Fotini Christia, I'm hearing a shift here. The policy has gone from nation building to containment.
That would be correct. Peace with the Taliban, and it's very feasible and the optimal strategy to follow.
All right, containment in Afghanistan, in the words of Fotini Christia, assistant professor of political science at MIT. Coming up, we talk about food every Tuesday. How do you make meals that your kids will enjoy eating? How about letting your kids help you? We'll talk about the benefits of cooking with your kids, especially when the kids make great food. I'm serious. Good kids making great food, having their own restaurants.
We're not talking about my kid. Let me be clear.
Yes, this does not involve
make
peanut
no mistake.
Butter. There is no peanut butter. This is a peanut butter-free segment coming.
Right, peanut butter and chocolate chips.
That's right. This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry.
And I'm Celeste Headlee. Today marks 65 years since the liberation of the Auschwitz concentration camp. Takeaway producer Irva Gunja spoke with a survivor from Auschwitz, Sonia Wachowski. We should mention to our listeners some of the conversation might be graphic in content. As background, in 1939, when Sonia Wachowski was 13, her family was uprooted by the Nazis. Her father and brother went into hiding, but they were found, shot, and killed. Sonia and her mother were sent to the Majdanek concentration camp in Poland.
They performed rites there, a selection, and whoever was still, you know, older or young children were straight went to the gas chamber. And for some reason, my mom and myself, we made it through, and we have been in this camp for a half a year.
But her mother would not get out alive.
Something was pushing me to the door. It was a big door, and it had a little tiny, a little peephole. And I looked through the little peephole, and I'll never forget, as long as I shall live, I saw my mom holding together in a long column with other women. They were taking him to the gas chamber. This was a night I really fell apart. And the next morning, they shipped us to Birkenau, Auschwitz.
Sonia spent a year at the Auschwitz concentration camp. And among the other horrors that she witnessed, she saw the burning of two trucks full of the bodies of small children.
If you read about the hell, this was the greatest hell. I was working one day close from a crematorium, and I shall never forget, like two trucks, open trucks, those little tiny children, they looked like little geese from the far. They were wearing white little shirts. And after a while, you look, the smoke, and that's they went. Those little angels, little tiny children, I'll never forget this.
Three times, Sonia Wachowski was able to escape being sent to the gas chamber, and even after that, she was sent on a death march to the Bergen-Belsen concentration camp. It was during her time there that Auschwitz was liberated. Sonia's telling her story today to refute those who deny the Holocaust. Sonia Wachowski is now 84 and lives in Kansas City, today marking the 65th anniversary of the liberation of the Auschwitz concentration camp.
A long time after I came out of this from this hell, I could not talk about it. I could not even smile.
Good morning, everyone. John Hockenberry here with Celeste Headlee. So kids cooking their own food. What parent couldn't get behind a program like that?
I don't know. I'm not sure I want to eat everything that Grant cooks.
Here's the upgrade. What if kids cooked great food that you'd want to eat even at a restaurant? Coming up, the solution. Kids cooking. Kids cooking really, really well. But right now, here's a check on leading stories at 48 minutes after the hour. During tonight's State of the Union address, aides say the president will return to proposals that got him elected. He'll also introduce new measures to create jobs and increase education funding. During the speech, the First Lady will reportedly host two police officers credited with stopping the shooting rampage at Fort Hood back in November. We want your response. What's our State of the Union? Maybe it's political.
This is Mary from Brooklyn. I think considering all of the repeated Republican statements of not giving this president anything, my six words are, ha, Obama, no soup for you.
Tell us your take at 877-8MY-TAKE or post it to our site, thetakeaway.org, and respond to the speech, if you will. You can reach us at 877-8MY-TAKE.
The president will also touch on the national debt tonight. Republican Senator Jed Gregg says he's concerned for future generations.
What's coming at us is a fiscal crisis of inordinate proportions, which will probably leave this nation in a situation where it will either be fiscally bankrupt or confronting a massive reduction in the standard of living for our children.
Now moving from domestic to international fiscal health, the great and the good from the world of business and economics have gathered in the Swiss mountain retreat of Davos for this year's World Economic Forum. Economic recovery and banking reform, big talking points there. The BBC's Bridget Kendall joined us earlier from Davos in Switzerland. I asked her if we should expect some arguments between policymakers and the banking industry execs.
Well, I think there won't be a meeting of minds immediately. Last year, a lot of the top bankers stayed away in the aftermath of the crisis that there was. They just didn't want to be seen here, certainly not on the ski slopes or anywhere near a glass of champagne. This year, they are here, but I think a lot of the most heated discussions are going to go on in the corridors, maybe not on the podium.
And what do you hear going on in the corridors?
Well, you know, on the one hand, there are people saying, well, banks do need to be regulated more. We need to divide their retail activity away from more speculative things that they get up to, and maybe that they should not be doing that. On the other hand, there are people from the banking world who are saying, you know, too much government regulation could hamper any signs of recovery that we're seeing. So it's two sides who have two very different arguments. And I think the sense you get here in Davos is that no one has any clear vision of quite what we're going to expect going forward, given how unexpected the last year or so has been. And so there's quite a degree of uncertainty, and therefore I think a lot of heated debate.
Okay, that's Bridget Kendall from our partner, the BBC, reporting from Switzerland about the World Economic Forum. Those are some of the news stories that we're watching this morning.
Well, they're probably eating pretty well over there in Davos, wouldn't you say?
I would imagine they are.
Not as well as we're going to be in the studio in just a moment. You know, one of the great things about the 21st century, about the internet era with the proliferation of cameras and YouTube, is that you can Google little girl squash soup and actually watch and listen to this.
Hi, I'm the little girl in the kitchen, and it is really cold outside. So there's nothing better when it's cold out than a nice hot bowl of soup. So today we're making a spiced butternut squash soup that just has all the flavors of winter in it.
Yes, and the voice behind that YouTube video, it's actually Little Girl in the Kitchen. It's a TV show created by 11-year-old. 11-year-old, right?
Yeah.
Romilly Newman, who is in the studio. Good morning.
Good morning.
And you've actually brought us a butternut squash soup.
Well, it's a tomato soup.
Tomato soup, okay, with basil and some pesto.
Right, some creme fraiche.
We're going to talk about that. But first, why did you decide to create your own cooking show as an 11-year-old?
Because I was always so inspired by, you know, the Food Network and all those shows. And I always watched it, and I thought, you know, having these shows teaching people how to cook would kind of be my own little way of having that.
And who's, aside from the Food Network, who's your vision of a great cook? Is it your mom?
No, she can't cook.
Oh, I see. And she's in the control room there, yes.
Maybe that's why you've become a good cook.
It wasn't the family where you get passed on, you know, your great-grandmother's pasta recipe, and it just wasn't that.
So this is something you initiated on your own.
Yeah, it was kind of a thing that I kind of said, let's do this.
And you've been on Good Morning America and CBS News, I believe?
The early show, yeah.
The early show, yeah. So the fact that YouTube is out there and people can find you means you've got a little bit of a following.
That's what I try to say, but,
well,
you know.
Congratulations, Romilly Newman. And also with us is Elisa Volland, who's founder and president of Mini Chef, a cooking school for 3 to 13-year-olds right here in New York City. Good morning.
Good morning.
Now, you know, getting kids to cook is a labor-saving device for parents, but it's also a learning tool on a lot of different fronts. So what have you observed?
Well, absolutely. It's definitely a social, emotional, and also healthy benefit to getting your kids in the kitchen with you.
And, you know, we've actually discovered this in my home. Romilly, you're friends with my two 11-year-old daughters,
Zoe
and Olivia. And they actually learned quite a few years ago the importance of reading by following recipes and following directions. What other skills are important for kids to learn if they cook on their own?
Sure. Well, for younger children, the 3 to 6-year-old group, I would start with counting and vocabulary. It's just a great way to get them involved in mixing and measuring. There's so many little lessons on also gross motor and fine motor skills that you can adapt and put in there. And then for the older kids, you can really have greater conversations about how's their day at school, what's going on in their life. It's really an introduction to more social bonding issues.
And then there are also people like Romilly Newman, where it's all about you being a star, right?
In a way, but I like to, I think, teaching kids about what they're eating and...
Really? So
and
that's important to you?
What they're, yeah, I think it's very important that, you know, healthy food can
healthy
taste
food.
Good.
All right, here's a question I have. All right, I've got 5 kids. All right, a lot of different approaches to eating, okay? And it's always... And I remember what I used to eat as a kid. Do you think of kid food as like an ethnic food? Like there's Hungarian food, there's Polish food, there's Italian food, and there's kid food. And if so, what would that be?
I think there is that. And I think it's kind of, you know, food that, you know, is kind of junky. And so I think that you have to kind of open your kids, you know, open the doors to your kids' food world.
So kid food is kind of narrow. So if I was making a salad and I put feta cheese on it, that's adult. If I put Rice Krispies on it, that's...
kids. Uh-huh. But I try to make it, you know, I try to teach kids that that feta cheese can taste good.
Well, if Celeste has a question for you. I'm going to get her
a
bowl
ready
of this
tomato
soup.
It's a big barrier, Elisa and Romilly, is that the look of food. Very often kids are afraid because something looks, to quote my son, gross. And it takes a number of bites before they realize that what looks disgusting to them, it doesn't taste so bad. Romilly?
How do you get kids past gross?
Yeah.
I think you have to kind of, you know, you have to just have them try it. And there are also ways to kind of hide vegetables, hide things, you know. You know, you can make a mashed potato with turnip in it. But, you know, they don't see that, but it just tastes good and they're getting their vegetables.
Elisa,
you know?
Do you teach vegetable hiding techniques?
Well, sure, absolutely, especially with children. You have to weave in the good stuff, basically, to get kids to eat it. But also the other thing is there are so many companies out there right now that are making molds, so you can make things in different shapes that are much more appealing to kids. You can make butterflies and bees, and they just have a greater interest in trying these foods if they like what they're eating.
Well, madame, I have a bowl of this for you. And Romilly, will you explain what it is that Celeste is eating here?
It's my take on, like, the classic tomato soup. Every kid loves tomato soup, so it has some red peppers in it, and it's kind of...
It's really flavorful.
Thank you.
Garnished with some pesto?
Some pesto oil.
Pesto oil? You made this pesto oil?
Pesto. You can buy store-bought pesto even and just water it down with olive oil, and then you kind of drizzle that on.
So what is your vision for Little Girl in the Kitchen, Romilly Newman?
I try to make it a wide variety. I try to make it food that not only is just for kids or just for adults. I try to make it food that kind of anyone can eat and anyone can love. And that's what I want.
But does that really mean you want to get on the Food Network? Is that really? Yeah, maybe.
That was one of the challenges.
All right. Elisa, take us out. What's a last thought for moms who are thinking of maybe letting their kids, or dads thinking of letting their kids actually get near the burners?
The last thought is actually it's much easier to cook with your kids than people think. There's so many things that kids can do in the kitchen, from prepping to mixing before they actually hit the oven.
All right. Thanks so much for the tomato soup, Romilly Newman and Elisa Volland. Kids can cook. Kids should cook. So kids, get cooking. There's a link to Romilly's show on our website. You can see some of her episodes and learn how to make easy dough and make your own wontons with your kids at thetakeaway.org.
That's also where you go to weigh in on the President's State of the Union address tonight. What are your 6 words to describe the State of our Union? 8778-MY-TAKE or post to our website, thetakeaway.org. And we hope that you come back to the website and repost after you've heard the address tonight and tell her what your reaction to the President's speech is. I'm Celeste Headlee.
I'm John Hockenberry. You can use more than 6 words on your reaction. This is The Takeaway.
Thanks for listening to The Takeaway podcast. If there's a story you think we should look at or a conversation you'd like us to start, drop us a line at 877-8-MY-TAKE or email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org.